This is Nightline.
Tonight, the campus protests explode across the country. We're at the encampment at Columbia University, which helped spark a movement.
It was a scary moment when the riot cops are coming into your college campus and putting you in zip ties.
We hear from the students speaking out, some demanding their school divest from companies profiting from the war, others saying they feel targeted as Jews.
One of my friends had his Israeli flag ripped out of his hands,
and people were throwing hard objects at him, including hitting him in the face and in the chest.
Pro-Palestinian supporters saying they won't stop protesting until their voices are heard.
Repression breeds more resistance.
With disruptions continuing to spread,
what happens if there's a stalemate?
Plus, coming together in Texas.
I mean, what we've seen in Gaza is unprecedented.
I do believe that Israel and the existence of a Jewish state in some form is necessary for the protection of Jews and the safety of Jews.
We're inside a small circle of students from disparate backgrounds.
I am Palestinian American.
I'm an Israeli American Jew.
My family is Mizrahi, Sephardi, and Ashkenazi.
Talking and, more importantly, listening to each other, trying to find common ground.
Nothing is more brave than being able to listen to somebody that disagrees with you fundamentally
and trying to answer the hard questions.
Can you be both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli at the same time?
Thanks for joining us. On nearly 50 college campuses from coast to coast this week, pro-Palestinian protests disrupted classes, triggered arrests, even led to the cancellation of graduation ceremonies at USC. Tonight, we've been listening to students, to the voices at the center of the flashpoints at Columbia University, where some Jewish students say they're feeling threatened, while protesters say they won't back down.
Across the nation and around the clock. From California to Michigan and along the East Coast, college campuses erupting in protest. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanding action, refusing to back down. As a string of outsiders try to join the conversation, tonight we hear from the students themselves. We're at Columbia University, the epicenter of the demonstrations that helped spark nationwide unrest.
The voices in Gaza are routinely massacred. On top of that, we have millions of Gazans within the Gaza Strip who are also displaced, starving day in and day out.
As tensions rose dramatically, Jewish students say they've experienced harassment and anti-Semitism. Some say they no longer feel safe on campus.
At this point, it's not about free speech anymore because it has crossed the line into direct harassment and assault. My friends had water thrown in their faces. One of my friends had his Israeli flag ripped out of his hands, and people were throwing hard objects at him, including hitting him in the face and in the chest.
To what extent is this about free speech versus disrupting classes?
The president of the university changed all classes to Zoom. Why should somebody like me, who is not disrupting anything, not be able to go to class because people in there want to do class via Zoom from inside of their tents? To me, that is totally absurd.
Protests first began on campuses after the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, where roughly 1,200 were killed and 250 were taken hostage, according to the IDF. Israel's war on Gaza has killed at least 34,000 Palestinians, according to the Hamas-run health ministry.
We're here for Palestine. This is not about us. This is not about the students. This is not about the college. This is about something so much more.
In December, the presidents of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania faced a congressional grilling on anti-Semitism. It led to their resignations. And just last week, Columbia University's president, Minush Shafik, was also called to testify.
Anti-Semitism has no place on our campus, and I am personally committed to doing everything I can to confront it directly.
The next day, the NYPD were called in to clear out the encampment built by protesters on Columbia's campus. Administrators say the students were breaking university rules. 100 people were arrested and charged with trespassing, including junior Sarah Boris, who is Jewish.
What went through your head when you were arrested?
It was a scary moment when the riot cops are coming into your college campus and putting you in zip ties. But I think that I knew these risks. I knew that that was the risk of the action I was taking.
Sarah was later suspended and lost access to campus, classes, and her dorm. But she says she has no regrets.
What I was taught as a Jew growing up is completely against the actions that you're seeing in Gaza at the hands of the IDF. You're seeing hospitals being destroyed. And that's just completely against everything I was taught, the value of human life as a Jewish person.
Soon after those arrests, the encampment came back stronger.
Repression breeds more resistance. The more that they repress us, the more that we will resist, and the more that our demands become truer and truer.
Yazoon El Moussa is a Palestinian-American dental student. He's been protesting on campus since October.
We've also had comments come at us that are very racist, that are very
Islamophobic,
anti-Palestinian. And our goal is to really to move past that, to understand that our values to free Palestine is in line with anti-Semitism. We've made our demands very clear and we haven't budged. We ask for financial transparency from all of Colombia's investments. We ask full divestment from all of the profiting that Colombia gets within the bombing within the Gaza Strip. And amnesty for all the students who spoke up.
What happens if there's a stalemate?
We stand steadfast. If anything Palestinians have taught us, it's steadfast within our land. And our people know that. Every single protester knows that. And we will not move. We will not budge.
Give me a sense of just how delicate that dance is that the university president has to deal with.
They're juggling students, they're juggling parents, alumni, donors, politicians, these outside actors, even residents of the community who all have stakes in this issue. I think they're trying to make choices as to what do you prioritize here? And that's an incredibly almost impossible answer.
Isabella Ramirez is the editor-in-chief of the student-run newspaper, the Columbia Daily Spectator.
Where have you seen the line between free speech and hate speech?
That line people draw in different places, and I think that's also part of the issue. Some people say, no, this chant does not mean that. And other people say, well, this chant makes me deeply feel unsafe and uncomfortable.
Sophomore Alicia Baker is a Middle Eastern history major who speaks out in op-eds in the school paper.
So for 6.5 months, we've been calling out the threatening rhetoric and saying, you know, this is anti-Semitic. And we've been told, well, you're interpreting it wrong. And to me, that was an anti-Semitic double standard, too. Why are Jews the only minority group that when we call out threats against us, we're told that we're interpreting it wrong?
Back in January, Columbia student protester Kaimani James live-streamed anti-Semitic comments.
Be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists.
Today, university officials announcing they're barring him from campus. James issued a statement saying, in part, what I said was wrong. Every member of our community deserves to feel safe without qualification. Protest organizers distancing themselves from James.
He apologized and he asked for space to reflect and learn and grow, and that he will step away from being press spokesperson.
When you have people chanting bomb Tel Aviv and saying that they're Hamas, I don't think that's activism.
Junior Chaya Dresnik says she and her friends have been the targets of anti-Semitic vitriol.
We went to observe a protest that was going on, and they started targeting their chants towards us. They ended it off with, October 7th will be every day for you guys.
I'm a Jew just like they did all the soldiers on October 7th.
Good.
You see how many soldiers we got? Yo, y'all got smoked, bro. We about to be in a pack with them.
One of the groups involved in the protests, the Columbia University Apartheid Divest, said in a statement, our movement is united in valuing every human life.
We are against all forms of bigotry. We do not stand for that. We allow every single person into our camp. We do not reject people based on ethnicity, based on religion. We ask that everyone respects those community guidelines, to be respectful to the people around them.
Student activism on colleges is stitched into the fabric of American history, from civil rights protests in the 1960s to the anti-Vietnam War unrest that left 4 people dead at Kent State University at the hands of the Ohio National Guard. With the weight of history on their shoulders, Columbia's students and administrators continue to negotiate, with the countdown to commencement less than 3 weeks away.
And when we come back, on a college campus in Texas, a group of students from different sides of the debate determined to find common ground.
The state, no doubt, and a disgraceful governor who said.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. You're about to meet a group of students at the University of Texas at Austin who hold a variety of opinions on Israeli-Palestinian issues. What sets them apart is that they're not just determined to work out their differences, but amidst the turmoil, they call themselves family. Here's my Nightline co-anchor, Byron Pitts.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. This is a very important and special dialogue, so let's get started. The ground rules will be usual. This will be civil.
For the next 90 minutes, these college students will speak hard truths to each other in the hardest of times.
I mean, what we've seen in Gaza is unprecedented. Like, it is on a different scale. There are no universities left. There are no hospitals left. It is unlivable.
But I do believe that Israel and the existence of a Jewish state in some form is necessary for the protection of Jews and the safety of Jews.
They're all students at the University of Texas, Austin, all desperate for common ground. Amidst the bloodshed in Gaza and Israel, they have family and friends in both places.
We're called Atidna, so we combine the Hebrew word Atid for future with the Arabic suffix Na for our, and you put those two together, it means our future. We gave our group that name because we truly view ourselves as one family, and we think it's important to allow families to speak.
Jews, Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims, students from across America and around the globe.
I'm a Mexican-American Jew.
I am Iraqi, proud of it, and Muslim as well.
I am Palestinian-American.
I'm originally from Iraq.
I'm an Israeli-American Jew.
My family is Mizrahi, Sephardi, and Ashkenazi.
Elijah Kallenberg founded Atidna International in 2022. He's 21 and Jewish. Jed Hashem is the group's vice president. He's 20 and Palestinian.
Can you be both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli at the same time?
Of course.
100%.
You can be both.
I believe firmly that you can be pro-human being, first and foremost, because we are human beings, and human rights must extend to everybody on an equal level.
Historically, with human nature, it's hard to have conversation when the blood is warm.
Yeah.
Right now, the blood is hot.
Very hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so, yeah. And we still think at the end of the day that this is the time to do it. We must take action somehow. We've both had family affected.
Yeah.
This is the least that we can do to get something on the grounds here at a grassroots level.
It's a tall order. Just outside, protests erupting on UT's campus, joining the demonstration sweeping campuses nationwide.
Peaceful protest is all right.
More often than not, shouting begets more shouting. But in here, there's a quiet space to speak their truth and to listen.
This group is a safe space for you.
This is a safe space. I think the existence of this group, the existence of a group that has Jewish and Palestinian dialogue and Jewish-Arab dialogue, Israeli-Palestinian dialogue, sends a message.
It's so easy to resort to hate and fear, and these are all feelings that I'm sure we all have, even if we don't want to admit them. It's so easy. It's so easy to fall into these echo chambers.
If I may ask, who at this table is managing fear right now?
At the end of the day, whether we agree on stuff or not, we all agree that we are all human and that we are all worthy of respect and dignity.
October 7th was a turning point for this group.
I will say, after October 7th, there was a lot of people that said, this is no longer for me. They said, we cannot be in the same space.
Is that right? People
yes.
left your group.
We had people
after
leave. We had a lot of people leave.
But the group says it began to grow again. The members even organized a vigil a month after the war began.
For UT students to see Israeli students, Palestinian students, professors, to see faith leaders come together, that really resonated with the entire community. I think that what we did is so, so powerful.
When you see these images from what happened on your campus to other campuses, is there a sense of pride, like right on? Is there a sense of anxiety, fear? What's your reaction to it when you see it?
The one feeling I feel is, oh, this is going to be bad, just selfishly. I don't think that people might take this anger out on Jews. They might see this as further proof that there is no middle ground and that there is no nuance. There's a lot of people that don't know what the heck they're talking about. The amount of non-Arabic leftists who are speaking over Palestinians instead of with them, and the amount of non-Jews who are speaking over Jews instead of with them is infuriating. They should be speaking with us and listening to us and uplifting our voices.
Yes.
They shouldn't be speaking over us. They
yes.
silence us.
The most American thing that has been done is always a lot of protests have occurred on college campuses, right? Whether it be, anti-war protests, anti-apartheid in South Africa.
Sure. Civil rights in 1960s.
Civil rights, especially.
While some of them have participated in protests, their main focus is conversations like these.
I would be doing a disservice if I wasn't having dialogue.
Yeah.
It's the way to find solutions to this. At the end of the day, if we all want to live in the land, we got to talk somehow.
Yeah.
We got to talk before it's too late. Find dialogue now before it's too late.
What is more authentic than allowing two people who, are portrayed as hating each other to be in the same room and say everything that they want to say without anybody telling them that they can't say it.
And not only that, agree on almost.
Really even find a way to have coexistence outside of it. I think we are going chest to chest. Mm-hmm. Nothing is more brave than being able to listen to somebody that disagrees with you fundamentally and also allowing yourself to take that in.
And that's their hope. If they can build civility in a classroom on a campus, could it spread? Some of the founding fathers of America were 20-somethings, they remind me. Brilliant ideas have beaten barbarism and brutality before, so why not now? For Elijah and Jan, these meetings help foster kinship in this fraught moment.
It seems to me part of the tension is, historically and in this moment, in order for you to win, he has to lose. In order for you to win, he has to lose.
I don't believe our aspirations conflict. I think if we win, we can win as a group. If I win, Jad wins. If Jad wins, I win.
Part of me thinks, oh, that's so sweet. That's so incredibly naive.
Mm.
What say you?
I say people who think it's naive are those who have been stuck in the past. I think they've never been able to meet the other. And by meeting the other, you break down a world of hate.
Disappointed by leaders around the world, their activism is their answer to this dilemma, generations old.
What's your hope?
I will give three words, mutual understanding, nonviolence, and reconciliation. That is my hope for the future.
I will say very similarly, I think the future is unity through a common identity. I think it's viewing each other as family and not as enemies. And through doing that, we can have peace. It's going to happen one day.
Our thanks to Byron. We'll be right back.
As in previous campaigns, it's the economy, stupid. We'll be looking at that this morning.
First, though, it's the news, stupid.
It is the economy, stupid.
It's not the economy, stupid.
It's national security, stupid.
It's the hair, stupid.
In 1992, one of the best-known pieces of presidential campaign wisdom was born. It's the economy, stupid. But was it actually the economy that won Bill Clinton that election? In a new series from the 538 Politics podcast, we're taking a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from, and does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts. The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's Nightline for tonight. Stay tuned to ABC News for the latest on the college unrest across the country. We'll see you right back here Monday. Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, America. Have a great weekend.
As in previous campaigns, it's the economy, stupid. We'll be looking at that this morning.
First, though, it's the news, stupid.
It is the economy, stupid.
It's not the economy, stupid.
It's national security, stupid.
It's the hair, stupid.
In 1992, one of the best-known pieces of presidential campaign wisdom was born. It's the economy, stupid. But was it actually the economy that won Bill Clinton that election? In a new series from the 538 Politics podcast, we're taking a look back at conventional wisdom from past elections with a critical lens. Where did that wisdom come from? And does it hold up today? Find the Campaign Throwback series in the 538 Politics feed wherever you get your podcasts.